This is the Morrow Midday Show.
But wait, there's more.
On ESPN Radio.
Guess who's back again. Shady's back. Tell a friend. Guess who's back, 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 guess who's back.
Final hour of the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcasts. And the podcasts are also available online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Just click on our show page. You can always get in touch with the show by heading to charlestonsportsradio.com, clicking on our show page, leaving a comment there. On Twitter at Morrow Middays. Text the show 843-608-1734. Or you can always join the conversation on the phones 843-721-9500. We've been talking about college football realignment today. Last hour, talking about the ACC media poll. I meant to bring it up at the time, but I find it interesting. When you look at college football, there's three clear favorites in college football this year, and from a betting perspective. And it's Alabama, Ohio State, and Georgia. Then you get to everybody else. Clemson has the fourth best odds, but there's a pretty good gap between them and the top three. And then after Clemson, there's a pretty big gap between them and everyone else. More bets have been placed this offseason so far in USC winning the national championship than any other college football program. Now, part of this are because of the odds. They have much greater odds. You're not going to bet necessarily on Alabama, Ohio State, or even Georgia, because just based off of the odds, it's not necessarily worth it. You know, they're the favorites. So you'll take a better payout with USC. But I do find it interesting that they are the number one team. There's a lot of faith and belief in Lincoln Riley and USC immediately in year one. And they're similar to Clemson. We've always compared Clemson to, like, Pete Carroll's USC, right? Dabo's Clemson is like Pete Carroll's USC when he really had USC humming out there. And it was a conference that they could dominate, and you know, Clemson could dominate the ACC, and then you get that playoff spot and brought in some really talented pieces. Dabo and Pete Carroll have some similarities where they're more of that cheerleader. They hire really good coordinators, and they're just the guy that overlooks the program, good recruiters, always positive guys. So you see those similarities, and we always thought for USC they could get back to that point with the right coach, right? Like, that's still on the table for them. The Pac-12 is still there for the taking. You just need either the right coach there, somebody like a Pete Carroll from 15 years ago, or you need somebody who could bring in the talent, and those probably go hand in hand, the coach and the talent. But Lincoln Riley certainly has brought in the talent. But if you were to look ahead to this year in college football, which team would you trust more? Now, again, the odds probably say, yeah, it's a better bet to just take USC. But if the odds are equal, who would you rather bet on, Clemson to win the national championship this year or USC? Or to phrase it another way, who do you think would be the best team outside of the three favorites that could actually win a national championship this year? Because we have the clear-cut top tier of college football this season in Ohio State, Alabama, and Georgia, and then everybody else. Which of those other teams would you trust the most? Clemson, what they have going for them is that they at least have shown themselves. You know, Dabo has shown that he's capable. Lincoln Riley has never won. He's gotten to the playoffs and then has been embarrassed. Right, his program hasn't been able to break through. Now, you could say, well, that was an Oklahoma thing. Now he's at USC. All right, well, for USC, we've never seen them during the playoff era compete to go actually win the Pac-12 or make it to the playoff. And maybe it's a faulty logic, but we do it a lot. You know, it's kind of human nature that we don't really buy into something until we see it for the first time in often cases. And so for Clemson, I mean, we've seen, maybe not with these coordinators, but we've seen Dabo win. Maybe not with this quarterback, maybe not even with this roster, but, you know, we know what Clemson's capable of and what Dabo's capable of and the championships they've won in recent years. For USC, it's a lot to expect in just year one. You bring in all these transfers, all these different pieces, and now we think Lincoln Riley, suddenly now he's going to have a team that could compete on a national stage with the SEC, which he did not have at Oklahoma. Maybe, right? There is greater talent out in the West Coast. There's a reason why he went from Oklahoma to USC. You can get theoretically better talent there, better resources, and you brought your quarterback, Caleb Williams. But to answer my original question, I do think, at least for this year, I still trust Clemson more than USC to go win a national championship. I think they're both in a similar boat where they can both win their conferences this year. They could. I think Clemson has a better chance of winning the ACC than USC has winning the Pac-12. I think Clemson has the recent history of showing that they've gotten it done. Dabo's actually won national championships. Lincoln Riley has not coached in a national championship. And then I also think there's a better second team in the Pac-12 than the ACC, right? Like, I think Utah's better than maybe even USC this year, but anybody else that the ACC could offer up not named Clemson. So I don't know if USC even wins their conference this year. I don't know if Clemson wins the ACC this year. They'd be my pick. But as we talked last hour, I think the ACC is a little more open this year. Could be more intriguing. And we'll see what happens. The one big difference, the one advantage that USC does have is the quarterback. You hear me talk about it ad nauseum. In order to compete for a national championship or win a national championship, you need elite quarterback play. I don't think Clemson will have elite quarterback play this year. I think that's what holds them back. Defense is going to be really good. Will Shipley should be really good. I think the coaching will be just fine. Obviously, the head coach has already won national championships before. Conference is winnable. I think it all falls on the shoulders of DJ and or Cade Klubnik if he replaces him. And that's the big difference. For USC, you have Caleb Williams, which is probably a big reason why so many people are high on USC, because they have one of the, who we believe, to be one of the best quarterbacks in the country. And the other two, Bryce Young, C.J. Stroud, are on the two programs that have the best odds to win the national championship. So you feel like you're getting really good value at USC. When you look at the three best quarterbacks in college football, Bryce Young, C.J. Stroud, Caleb Williams, two of them are on the two favorites. So it's like the old Sesame Street, right? One of these things is unlike the others. Yeah, USC, where they have one of the best quarterbacks in the country. They have a coach who at least has won conferences before. They've brought in a lot of talent to the roster. But you're giving me whatever they are. They're like plus 1,200 or something. Right? You're giving me these big odds, too. So I do understand from a betting perspective why USC is the most bet-on team to win the national championship. But to change the premise and ask the question of outside of those three favorites, Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State, who would you trust the most? I still think I trust Clemson more than USC for year one. You want to ask like the next 10 years? It could be different. I think Lincoln Riley will be good for the Trojans. I think they could build something. But this year, I do think Clemson will have a better chance of winning the national championship. I think Clemson has a better chance of being a playoff team this year than USC. Other teams outside of those top three favorites, there's not a lot to choose from. Like, do you trust anybody else in the Big Ten to win a national championship this year? Because I don't. Do you trust anybody else in the Pac-12 besides USC? I think Utah potentially could be a playoff team. If I had to pick somebody that could maybe make the playoff out of that conference not named USC, maybe Utah. I don't think Utah could go win a national championship this year. I think they get blown out by an Alabama. I mean, they did hang in there with Ohio State, but, you know, it wasn't the playoff last year. You always have to wonder about, in that case, for Utah, that was their national championship. For Ohio State, that was a disappointment. I would like to see them play in the playoff. I think it could be different. In the Big 12, I don't think any of those teams, Oklahoma, Texas, or anybody else, is a national champion contender. And the ACC outside of Clemson, I don't think anybody. And then the SEC, maybe we get a surprise, right? Maybe a Texas A&M this year. Or maybe an Arkansas, or who knows? The SEC is talented enough that just like LSU a couple years ago, you may not have saw that coming. Maybe you didn't perceive, you didn't expect Georgia's dominance a year ago. The SEC is so talented, and they bring in so much talent. Those programs are good that's the one conference that could maybe surprise you. Because any one of those programs could have a big year. So point being, those are really the only two teams I think realistically you'd want to choose from anyways, like USC and Clemson, if not picking the top three. And USC provides better odds, so you'd probably rather bet on USC than Clemson. But realistically, I still think Clemson has the better chance of winning the national championship. That's probably why they have the fourth best odds in Vegas. I would put them fourth as well. But I did see that little tidbit, that anecdote, that more people have bet on USC than anybody else. And I did find it interesting. Just like Zach Wilson has received like some of the most MVP votes, or I should say MVP bets, because of maybe some off-the-field, off-season storylines, and because of the great odds in the NFL. Speaking of quarterbacks in the NFL, Trent had sent me an article last night from Pro Football Talk about the Minnesota Vikings GM being brutally honest with Kirk Cousins about how he may not be the guy, may not be good enough to go win a Super Bowl. After what Rodgers did, I think Kirk Cousins, he's going to have to show up now, right, to training camp as some other Nick Cage character. That'll really win the people over. I don't know what other character you could dress up as. I don't know what other character Kirk Cousins really looks like. I think that may be the move.
An insurance salesman? He could do that. That'd be good. A librarian, potentially?
Yeah.
No disrespect to those job, those jobs, but Kirk Cousins looks like he would work in that field, potentially, enterprise car salesman.
That's true. I was thinking of some sort of role of Jason Bateman where he, wore a suit in a movie or something.
He just shows up at Marty Bird, with a denim shirt and slacks.
I think that would fit well. Now, if he was going for Nicolas Cage, right, because that's the flavor of the week right now. If he's trying to copy Rodgers and he says, man, I got to dress up like a Nick Cage character now. There was one movie where Nicolas Cage was like a con artist. It came out about 20 years ago. It was actually a pretty good movie. Most of Nick Cage's movies are horrendous, especially in the last 10 years. He does any film that requests his services. But there was one movie about 20 years ago where he was a con artist, but he was oftentimes in a suit. And that'd probably be the one. I'm trying to think of the name of it. Maybe it was Matchstick Men. I think that was it. It was actually a good movie. Matchstick Men from about 20 years ago. And Nicolas Cage was oftentimes in a suit. Or he also wore a suit in Lord of War. Right? Wasn't that the one when he was selling guns and ammunition? I don't think Kirk Cousins, though, has the boldness to pull off a character like that. I also got thinking because while we're on the subject of Kirk Cousins, since I brought us here, there was a story about a week ago where former Vikings linebacker Ben Lieber, who now works as a media member in Minnesota and he works on the radio broadcast, he told the story, or just really an anecdote, or his opinion even, on CBS Sports Radio last week that went viral, in which he said he thought Mike Zimmer, the former head coach of the Vikings, him and Kirk Cousins did not like each other. They hated one another. And so it got me thinking, how many coaches in the NFL do you think actually hate their quarterbacks right now? Because I don't think Mike Zimmer was the only one. If you were to look through the NFL teams and wonder about coaches that may hate their quarterbacks, and as the old cliche goes, right, hate may be too strong of a term. But which coaches are like, man, this guy, this is the guy I'm stuck with? If you were to look around, Zach Wilson probably went in the opposite direction after this offseason, right? You feel even happier, like, yeah, that's our guy right there. But otherwise, if he's not unhappy yet, if he doesn't hate him yet, I could see Ron Rivera by the end of the season, like most of the other coaches in his career, being upset with his quarterback, Carson Wentz. Like, oh, this is the guy you give me this year? We went from Taylor Heineke to Carson Wentz. Are you kidding? I could see Brian Daboll with Daniel Jones. He just went from Josh Allen. Now he's got Daniel Jones over here. It's a new relationship. But I can see pretty quick where Daboll, it's like from Seinfeld with Frank Costanza, when he wouldn't take his shoes off when he went to that woman's house way back when. And the father says, this guy, he's not my type of guy. Same idea. That's what Brian Daboll is probably saying already at training camp when he goes from Josh Allen to Daniel Jones. He's watching him thinking, yeah, this is not my type of guy. We need somebody else here. I imagine Dan Campbell probably can't stand Jared Goff. Because Dan Campbell, they seem like polar opposites. And Goff is really conservative and Campbell's I just saw a video today of Campbell doing drills with his guys at Detroit training camp. He seems to be balls to the wall, all in. Jared Goff at least gives off the perception of kind of being the opposite. It's probably part of the reason why the Rams got rid of him. Matt Rhule probably every year feels that way about his quarterback. And right now with both Sam Darnold and Baker Mayfield, again, if he's not already feeling it now, probably by midseason he's thinking, oh my God, this is what my job's on the line. This is what I'm stuck with. I got to choose between Sam Darnold and Baker Mayfield. I think he probably already feels that way about Darnold after last year. That's why you go out and you get a Baker, because he's the best option for you. But pretty quickly, especially if Baker may act kind of how he did in Cleveland, Rhule's going to be thinking, oh, my future in the NFL, it falls on these two guys? I'm screwed. I could see Matt Rhule pretty quickly hating his quarterbacks. And again, maybe hate's a strong word, but really being upset with the situation he finds himself in. I know Pete Carroll right now is probably ticked off. I don't think he wants to rebuild at age 70. I don't know if he wanted to get rid of Russell Wilson. He won kind of that war of egos, so maybe he appreciates that. But then he looks around, you got Geno Smith and you have Drew Locke, and you're 70 years old, Pete. All right, probably on your way out, you're thinking, oh, geez, these are the guys we're going to have to coach? These are the guys that we're going to have to try to win with. You go from Russell Wilson to those guys. I think there may be quite a few coaches that we got the story last week. Everybody, right, because it's you see it as a headline. Mike Zimmer hated Kirk Cousins. It's easy to run with. But then I think if you go through the league, I think there's a lot of coaches that if you got them in a room, again, hate's probably too strong a word. I don't know if they'd say, I hate that guy. But they would tell you, like, oh, I can't stand our quarterback. I wish we had somebody else. I think Mike Vrabel would probably tell you the same thing right now with Ryan Tannehill.
I was going to say, Vrabel is probably the biggest one out of every team. He despises Ryan Tannehill. There's no doubt about it. And he had no better options outside of Malik Willis, who's probably a project for the next 5 years.
And I'll tell you what, most coaches probably wouldn't say it. Vrabel would be the one guy that would like go on a podcast or something and tell you, like, oh, yeah, Tannehill, like, I don't really like that guy.
As soon as he's out of Tennessee, he's going to be like, we never liked him. Yeah. We never liked him.
Absolutely. The same guy that said he would cut off his junk to win a Super Bowl. You kidding? The moment they get – that's going to be the press conference. We never liked him. He's an idiot. I hate that guy. I'm glad he's gone. That's going to be Vrabel with his mustache. Oh, we were just talking about mustaches the other day. You know what? Vrabel's the one that he can kind of pull it off.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Now, do you think there's any quarterbacks out there that hate the head coach? Like, just flip it on its head as of right now?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. There has to be, right? There has to be at least a quarter of the NFL.
You played sports growing up.
Yeah.
Everybody hates their coach.
Oh, man. Oh, boy.
Most athletes, because they think they're wronging them or they should have a greater opportunity. All right, if we were to look at that, I could see Dak Prescott not liking Mike McCarthy very much.
Absolutely.
Especially the way the playoff game ended. And, like, Dak, it was kind of like who was at fault for that time management. And they talked about practicing the play. And most people blame McCarthy. But then a lot of people are blaming Dak of saying, you're the quarterback. You've got to be smarter. You should have slid earlier. Should have been a little quicker on spiking the foot. You should know how much time's left. So it was almost like a blaming game this offseason of who's more responsible. Dak's probably sitting at home like, why is everyone blaming me? The stupid coach. That was his idea. So certainly Dak Prescott. I would tell you last year they probably all hated Urban Meyer in Jacksonville.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's pretty high. Would you think that Derek Carr and Josh McDaniels, if it doesn't go well, Derek Carr might think a little different about this cat McDaniels?
Yeah, I could see so. You know, McDaniels, and again, we're just trying to interpret from the outside looking in. He's from that Belichick school. Whenever they show him on the sidelines, like, he's never smiling. He's always got his visor on. He doesn't seem like a very friendly guy or a fun guy to be around. But people have also said that since his head coaching opportunity with Denver, you know, he kind of learned from his mistakes, and he has lightened up in recent years, and he is more, like, personable and jokey and everything. So maybe he's more pleasant to be around. But, yeah, like, if things aren't going well, he's the new coach that comes in. He's an offensive coach. Carr had a pretty good year last year. If the team's struggling this year, if things aren't going well, yeah, I'm sure he'll be kind of missing John Gruden. Maybe not for some of the things Gruden said in emails, but him and Carr bought a house, like, live on the same street as Gruden. They had a pretty good relationship. So now you have the new coach come in, and if things don't go great, I could see Carr souring on Josh McDaniels with how tough he may be. But as I think about it, maybe there's not as many obvious examples of the disliked coaches. I'm running through the division by division here. I don't know. I don't really know about any of the other ones. I don't know how popular Matt Rhule even is in Carolina.
That's the thing, right? Like, it seems like there hasn't been a press conference where a player has come out and been like, I love Matt Rhule. He is phenomenal. So he might be one of those guys.
Yeah, could be. So, anyways, there you go. Since we went down that rabbit hole. I don't even know what we were going to get to in this segment, but that was more fun for me. Anyways. If you're missing the show, you can catch it on demand. Search ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcast. We did open the show talking about why I think the NFL could be at a bit of a crossroads heading into this season, depending on how things go this year with specific teams. And you can go find that on the podcast if you missed it from earlier. Plus, we covered the Big Ten Media Days, and we're all over that. There's three big talking points to come out of the Big Ten Media Days yesterday. The idea that the Big Ten's still looking to expand, we all should have assumed that. The second one being that the Big Ten is in favor of expanding the college football playoff. We all should have assumed that. The reason why we're realigning these conferences in college football, because of more money. It's the same reason why they're going to expand the college football playoff eventually, because of more money. And then the third aspect, too, was Kevin Warren was asked about this idea of, you know, maybe players actually getting a portion of the money made by the conference. Could help try to curb the transfer portal and people leaving, schools leaving even, players leaving, maybe other people would want to come into the Big Ten. And it'd be certainly a fascinating idea. I don't know if we'll get to that point. Then you'd be talking about right? They're almost employees of the school. And you'd also be talking about, like, the players would probably have to create a union, and that gets real dicey, and they've tried in the past in the Big Ten to come up with player unions that never really got far. But it would be intriguing, and I think if you're the ACC, you should almost take that idea and apply it to teams instead of splitting the amount of money you make evenly across all the teams instead, whichever team's doing the best. So, like, Clemson makes more money than everybody else because they're the most successful program in the conference. And that'd be a way to keep Clemson from trying to leave the ACC. They wouldn't have to go chase the money in the SEC because they're making now more money in the ACC. And it's based off of their own success. Could be at least an attempt to try to keep them happy. But in all these conversations, two things I think are pretty clear. Number one, the Big Ten's the linchpin of the conferences. I think they'd be the ones to make the next big move, even though they just made the last one. And if and when they do, it would force other conferences to try to make a big move. Right? It would start that domino effect. And I think of the teams, Notre Dame is the linchpin for a few different reasons. When you want to talk about playoff expansion, well, Notre Dame plays a big role in that. If you limit their source to the playoff, they then would may have to join a conference, therefore starting the dominoes of more conference realignment. When you talk about conference realignment, I think everybody would love to have Notre Dame be part of it, whether it's the Big Ten, the SEC, or even the ACC, to try to keep themselves alive. I think Notre Dame's the linchpin in all this, or they just stay independent. But if Notre Dame were to make a move to, say, the Big Ten, it could impact even what we do with the playoff in the future. It could impact how the SEC responds. It could impact what happens to the ACC. If Notre Dame joins the ACC, let's say, and maybe that's the biggest long shot, but it could keep them afloat, and then maybe we have three conferences, three power conferences that remain. If they join the SEC, then, ooh, talk about, right, dominance of a conference in college football. I think the Big Ten hold the cards of what's going to happen next because they're a little more desperate than the SEC. The SEC doesn't have to do anything. And I think Notre Dame kind of holds the cards of quite a few things. Right? They may not have to join. They may not join a conference until they're forced to because of the changes to a college football playoff. But those were the three big takeaways from Big Ten Media Days yesterday. That Kevin Warren's still talking about expanding. That when they're talking about the playoff expansion, they're talking 16 teams, which I think is way too many. There's not 16 champion contenders in college football each year. And the third part being, maybe we get to a point that not only name, image, and likeness, transfer portal, college conference realignment, all that sort of stuff, but also maybe even players are getting a portion of the money. College football, as you knew it, obviously is gone. And we'll continue to see these changes moving forward and the sport evolve and change, and hopefully good enough for you to still stick around and be a fan of the on-field product. When we come back, speaking of those changes and the moving around, which of the transfer quarterbacks has the most to prove in college football this year? Which one could have, like, the biggest resurgence? We'll get to that next. It's the Morrow Midday Show right here on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Although I'll not bring us in your memory ever, and everything looks so complete when you're walking out.
Which transfer quarterback has the most to gain this year in college football? It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. Plenty to choose from. I believe the final number was 21 quarterbacks transferred to Power 5 programs, at least in terms of expected starters. There are, 65 Power 5 schools, 21 brought in a transfer, so that's about a third of the Power 5. I'm really intrigued, before I get to my, the big names on the list, I'm really intrigued by the guys that transferred within the same conference, most notably in the SEC. Now, this is something. While I've always been pro-transfer, and the NCAA was talking about, allowing kids to transfer however many times they want without any sort of penalty, fine with me. I'm all for transferring. The one thing I don't like, though, is transferring within the conference. Because I don't want any sort of tampering going on in the handshake line after a game, trying to recruit a kid after you just played that team to come over to you. And then you get a little shady when, you know, he's playing for this team and then he goes over to another team to try to go beat them the next year. That's the one thing. I don't really like the idea of transferring with it. Transfer wherever you want, play right away. But if you go within the conference, I think that's when you should sit out a year. And conferences used to have that rule. They've all removed it. There was two conferences left this offseason, and they may have both made the change, where no longer do you have to sit out a year if you transfer within the conference. That's the one thing I would keep with the transfer portal. Otherwise, let them go whenever they want, or at least wherever they want. Maybe not whenever. Maybe not during the season. But transfer wherever you want. You don't have to sit out, you know, go play, but just don't go within the same conference. But all that's to say, I'm intrigued by a couple guys in the SEC. You have Max Johnson, son of Brad, friend of the show, who goes from LSU to Texas A&M and now plays there with Jimbo Fisher. And then you have the former quarterback at Texas A&M, Zach Calzada, go from A&M to now Auburn to replace Bo Nix, who transferred out. So that's intriguing to me. Right? The familiar faces in new places in the SEC, if you will. But when I think of quarterbacks with the most to gain, we've talked about this in the past about most pressure. This is different. Which quarterbacks have the most to gain? You know, Caleb Williams is the one that is on a top of, towards the top of a lot of lists when you talk about transfer quarterbacks. But I don't know if he'd be on the top of this list. Does he have the most to gain? Yeah, sure. Like if USC goes to win a national championship, of course. He could be a Heisman winner this year, potentially. We have high expectations. But he goes into this season, I think, with the highest stock of any transfer quarterback. In fact, he's different than most transfers. Most transfers transfer because they're looking for a new opportunity. They're looking to get away from their program, get away from their coach, go somewhere else where they can start or start, you know, fresh. For Caleb, that wasn't necessarily the case. He was just following Lincoln Riley, his coach, who went from Oklahoma to USC. So we've already seen Caleb Williams play. He played well last year. We have high expectations of him. It's not like he's trying to rebuild the public opinion on him, or he's trying to be reborn again, if you will, you know, save his career. That's not the case. We think Caleb Williams may be the Heisman winner this year. USC may be a playoff team. And if they're not, well, he still has at least one more year at USC next year before he has to go to the NFL anyways. So for Caleb Williams, I would exclude him from this conversation of which quarterback that had to transfer has the most to prove or has the greatest opportunity to turn themselves around. I thought of a couple of names. Let me work my way up from the bottom towards the top. I thought of guys like Keaton Slovis, Jackson Dart, Bo Nix as well. Now, Keaton Slovis, he transferred into Pittsburgh out of USC. And so what's interesting there is because you're replacing Kenny Pickett. So there's this idea of it being more about Pittsburgh than it was Kenny Pickett. Here's the concern for Pittsburgh. We were talking about the ACC earlier this afternoon. They also lost their offensive coordinator. And if you've been paying attention to Pittsburgh this offseason, their head coach really threw their former offensive coordinator, Mark Whipple, under the bus, Pat Narduzzi. And Pat Narduzzi made some comments about how he was surprised the team didn't run it more last year, right? Despite the year Kenny Pickett had. Think about that. You had the best quarterback statistically in program history, and the head coach is saying, hey, how come we're not running it more? Yeah, because you have a great quarterback. You don't need to run it. You gain more yards by throwing it. But defensive coaches, I just lived it with Mike Zimmer of my Vikings. They love to run the football. They like to play keep away, old physical football. We're going to play good defense. We're going to run the football. We're going to control the football. They don't like to pass. They don't like to be aggressive and take chances, defensive coaches. So my point being, new offensive coordinator at Pittsburgh, defensive head coach. I don't think Slovis will have the same output as a Kenny Pickett. I think the offense is going to be very different than what you saw last year for Pittsburgh. They're going to be more about defense, run the football, control the game, play a little keep away, play lower scoring games this year. That's what Pat Narduzzi wants to do. Then you have Jackson Dart, who's in a similar camp in that he transfers to Ole Miss, who just had a great season from Matt Corral, and he gets to go play for Lane Kiffin. He's another former USC quarterback that transferred out. USC had three quarterbacks that went and transferred, former USC quarterbacks. And Jackson Dart was a four-star recruit, played pretty well as a freshman at USC. He could go to Ole Miss, play really well, put himself, you know, back on the map here. I think he's going to have a good year. I laid out my reasons why last week on the show, but you go play for Lane Kiffin, he could try to fill those shoes of Matt Corral. So he has a lot to gain. Where you may not really know the name yet, Jackson Dart, but you could by the end of the year. He could propel himself into some conversations. And then there's Bo Nix, who left Auburn and went to Oregon. And I was never the biggest fan of Bo Nix. I remember Auburn fans used to reach out to the show and defend him and everything, and maybe more people came around to my side of the camp. I was never the biggest fan of Bo Nix, who started as a freshman there at Auburn. He goes to Oregon, where, you know, Oregon, they always have high expectations. New coach in Dan Lanning. The thing about Bo Nix, though, at Oregon is that he has a big opportunity here to try to, you know, win some people over. But Oregon also has one of the top quarterbacks in the country coming in behind him. So that puts more pressure on Bo, but it's one of those things like, well, if this doesn't work out, we'll be just fine next year. And then Bo's kind of forgotten. Now, if Bo Nix has a good year, then again, much like the other names I mentioned, he could try to propel himself higher up into that conversation. But it is Oregon. It's the Pac-12. It's out there on the West Coast. You're not paying as much attention. They got a big quarterback coming in. Bo still seems kind of to be a little bit of an afterthought. Then I get to the top three quarterbacks I thought of. When we're talking transfer quarterbacks in college football with the most to try to prove or save or, you know, the best opportunity to try to turn themselves around. And Dylan Gabriel's one that I thought of, who transferred to Oklahoma. It was a big get for Brent Venables there at Oklahoma. And the reason why I would put Dylan Gabriel high up on the list is because at UCF he suffered an injury that kept him out for the year. And so he's a little bit of a hidden gem. People aren't really focusing on Oklahoma getting him. That was a big-time get. And behind Caleb Williams, he may be the most talented quarterback that transferred. And then he's going to go play for Jeff Lebby, who was the offensive coordinator at Ole Miss last year for Matt Corral. So, you know, connect the dots here. You have a guy who put up, you know, some good numbers at UCF, suffered an injury, goes to Oklahoma, is going to play for the same OC that last year helped Ole Miss have that great offense. In Oklahoma with Venables, big brand, wide-open conference. Dylan Gabriel could be a guy coming off of an injury that kind of turns his career around and can see what he does for Oklahoma and really build something there. And then I get to the top of my list, where Spencer Rattler, yes, would be on the top of the list, but I'm not sure if he's one or if he's two. The two quarterbacks I think that could do the most for themselves this year after transferring would be Spencer Rattler, because the expectations were higher on him than any of these other guys. He's had a bigger fall from grace than anybody, and he's trying to dust himself off and get back up to that point, climb those steps again. And he could try to do that with a good year at South Carolina. He could try to turn himself back into a first-round pick. Right? Maybe he'll no longer be in the Heisman conversation, but maybe he's in the all-conference conversation. Try to turn himself back into an NFL quarterback, because right now, today, he's not there yet. And not only could he do a lot for himself, but a lot for the team as well. We've talked about this already this week and in the past weeks, that you just need that one. It'll open the door to a lot of other quarterbacks for you. So, you know, you can help me out. We can help each other, essentially. All right, Spencer Rattler, the Gamecocks need him. He needs them as well. He needs them to help him turn things around. They need him to show that good quarterbacks can come play for South Carolina. But the other one I also thought of is Quinn Ewers. Now, Texas may not need him as much as he needs them all of a sudden, because you have Arch Manning coming next year. But that only ramps up the pressure on Quinn Ewers. And so for Quinn Ewers to transfer there, he's the other one I thought of. Between him and Spencer Rattler, they are the two transfer quarterbacks to me that could have the biggest impact this year. If Ewers does not play well, what does the future hold for him? If he does play really well and Texas does return to being, you know, quote-unquote back, and they maybe win the Big 12, right? That's big time for Texas and that program and Sarkisian and Ewers' future and the future of college football when you consider, well, Arch Manning's supposed to be coming in next year. If he bottoms out, you wonder what his future holds with Arch Manning coming in next year. So between him and Spencer Rattler. Now, for Rattler, he could have a bigger impact on his program maybe than Quinn Ewers could, because Arch Manning's in the hopper. But I think those are the two transfer quarterbacks that, you know, could do the most for themselves and maybe their programs as well. I would say Dylan Gabriel's right behind them. And then other guys too, you know, Bo Nix, Jackson Dart, Keenan Slovis, who I mentioned, are all other ones too that could really elevate their stock and try to help the programs in which they're transferring into. Caleb Williams, I don't really put on the list because he's already high up. He's already considered a top three quarterback. He doesn't have to try to turn around his career by transferring. But these other guys can all do themselves a favor and maybe their programs as well. Nobody bigger than Spencer Rattler, and I would say also Quinn Ewers. Rattler would have a bigger impact on his program than Ewers. Therefore, maybe I'd go Rattler 1A and Quinn Ewers 1B. But Ewers may even be a bigger name at this point than Rattler is today. And then you also have Arch Manning looming, which is an interesting dynamic. Those are the two to me of all the transfer quarterbacks, and there were plenty. Those are the two guys that may have the most, you know, on the line just for themselves or their programs this year. When we come back, speaking of college football, the biggest swing games in college football this year. The More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Precious, I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years? Stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine? Are you reeling in the years? Stowing away the time? Are you gathering up the tears? Have you had enough of mine?
Time I've known you, I still don't know what you mean. The weekend at the college didn't turn out like you planned. The things that pass for knowledge I can't understand.
Are you reeling in the years?
Coming up, the biggest swing games in college football this year. It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Hey, what a rarity it is. It's a Wednesday, and knock on wood, it's not raining. And there's like a 10% chance of rain in the forecast. So if you listen to the show, you know Wednesday I go play pickup basketball. I may finally be able to get back out there. Fortunately, I'm going to be rusty again. It's been a while. So happy Wednesday to you. And knock on wood, hopefully the rain actually continues to stay away for once. Every Wednesday, it rains around here. Unbelievable. Hey, as we get ready for college football, week zero is a month from now for the college football season. What are the biggest swing games in college football this year? If we're just looking at September, right, non-conference games early in the year, I mean, we could point to just about every game in the SEC. I could tell you about Notre Dame and Clemson later on, but it's those early games that are bigger toss-ups. You have two conferences coming together, the non-conference games, where it's kind of an opportunity for the teams to prove themselves, who belongs, who doesn't. If we're looking at just September, just the first 3 weeks of the season, there's quite a few in week one. We have a handful of good non-conference games to start the year this season. And in week one, you get Cincinnati, you get Arkansas right away week one. First ever meeting between those two. Will Cincinnati be the top group of five team this year? Will they be competing for a playoff spot once again? Arkansas, will they be the third best team in the SEC that could potentially challenge Alabama for the division title and a spot in the SEC championship this year? You have Notre Dame and Ohio State week one. Ohio State, we believe, right up there with Alabama, is the favorite to go in a national championship. Notre Dame, I'm not too high on year one, but ESPN's FPI, they do give them the fifth best odds to go win it this year. I find that hard to believe. It is also year one of Marcus Freeman. He starts off right away with Ohio State. He's a defensive coach. Ohio State's going to have the most dynamic offense in the country. What are we going to get out of Notre Dame? We'll find out right away. And if Ohio State somehow loses that first game, boy, does that change a lot of things in college football. Wouldn't completely eliminate them or end their season, but it may change your perception of the top teams in college football. You also have Georgia-Oregon week one. I don't think Georgia loses a game in the regular season, but they go up against their now former defensive coordinator Dan Lanning at Oregon. And Oregon, of course, a pretty good program. And for Georgia, the first game since national championship, Oregon thinks they could win the Pac-12, maybe be a sleeper playoff team this year. Well, we'll find out right away. Week one should be an interesting game between those two. You also have Utah-Florida week one. Similar idea. How improved will Florida be this year under Billy Napier? And Utah, I'm really high on. I think they win the Pac-12. Could potentially be a fringe playoff team. But if you go week one and lose right away to Florida, a lot of people, maybe most people, will write you off. It wouldn't be a great start to the year, especially because Florida's not the same Florida that maybe you've been used to in the past. But that's a tough one for Utah right away. And then you also have Florida State LSU to a lesser extent. Most of these quote-unquote swing games are because of teams that are, you know, trying to impact the national championship this year. That's not the case with Florida State LSU. They're playing each other for the first time in over 30 years. But it will be interesting because for Florida State, this is a big make-or-break year for Mike Norvell. You start off with LSU in the Superdome. And for LSU, right, first game for Brian Kelly. And how much better will they be in year one? And you know, at LSU, there's always expectations. This is not some sort of rebuild year for Brian Kelly. And if you lose, essentially, a home game to Florida State, wouldn't it be a good start for Brian Kelly at his new job? No longer would they consider him family. So Florida State, LSU, also intriguing week one. In week two, there's a few more. You get Alabama, Texas. Now, I don't think Texas is on the same level as Alabama. But a couple of things. A couple of things to prove in this game. Is Alabama one of the favorites there with Ohio State. Are they one of the best teams in college football? And on the flip side for Texas, we're going to be asking, is Texas back? But they don't have to necessarily be back. They don't have to necessarily beat Alabama. Can they show that they're good enough to go win the Big 12? Actually compete this year after missing a bowl game a year ago. Week 2 also gives us Pittsburgh and Tennessee, which I think is a really interesting matchup. When they played last year, it was 41-34. Pittsburgh won. They've never lost to Tennessee. Pittsburgh's going to be a different team this year, though. You lose Kenny Pickett. You lose your offensive coordinator. They're going to be more, I imagine, about running the football. I think Tennessee will be the better team this year. But you have what I would say are the two second-place teams in their division. I think Pittsburgh will finish second in the Coastal. I think Tennessee will finish second behind Georgia. So they're not the best teams from their conferences, but, you know, they're pretty close. They're up there. It's a good matchup between the SEC and the ACC, and we'll find out what type of year Tennessee and Pittsburgh could expect this year when they play each other in Week 2. And then also Week 2, it is a conference game, but Kentucky-Florida right off the bat. And again, I go back to Florida. What are you going to get year one of Billy Napier? And Kentucky, they finished in second last year behind Georgia. How are they going to look this year as a follow-up? Last year was a touchdown game. Kentucky won by 7. And Florida was a bit of a mess a year ago. Could be interesting early on, right away. When you give me these early SEC games, right, like even South Carolina-Arkansas Week 2, you throw them right into the fire, Spencer Rattler's first conference game, that should be intriguing. What are we going to get out of Rattler and the Gamecocks this year? What should reasonable expectations be? And on the flip side for Arkansas, can they really be the third-best team in the conference? Can the Gamecocks provide them a little bit of a test Week 2 of the season? And then lastly, Week 3, as we look at just September games, right, because there's swing games all year long, and depending on how teams perform, a game we see now, right, may not seem as important now as it will a few weeks from now or a couple months when teams have a certain record this year. But the last ones I'll mention are Week 3. You get Penn State and Auburn. Penn State, I do think, will be better this year. Auburn, right, what are you going to get out of Brian Harsin with his job seemingly on the line? And you also have Miami, Texas A&M Week 3, which is another fascinating one. I'm not as high on Texas A&M, but some people think they could be a playoff team, or, you know, they could be that second team out of the SEC, or they could be the second-best team behind Alabama. I'm not so sure. But I am higher on Miami. I think Miami will win the Coastal, be in the ACC championship game, and I think they'll be much better under Mario Cristobal. And we'll see right away, Week 3, two programs that have not been good enough lately will play one another. Right? And only one's going to get out victorious. It'll be a big win for whichever team wins that game. Miami wins that game, that's a big early win for Cristobal to, you know, set the tone and make a statement. Vice versa, Texas A&M wins that game before going into the SEC schedule. That's a big non-conference win with that tough schedule they'll have. And it certainly will give them, I'm sure, a lot of confidence going up against the SEC teams the rest of the way. We could probably come up with more, but those are a handful of potential swing games to start the year in college football. They're most impactful early on because they set the tone. And because, as we know in college football, a lot of times an early loss can end your whole season, but also just for perception, how we look at these teams. A team wins a big non-conference showcase game, you kind of stop paying attention to them. You forget later on that, actually, that team, they're doing pretty good in their conference. Yeah, you already start ignoring them because, you know, they got blown out by Utah early in the year, and you thought, oh, they must not be that good. But teams obviously can get better as the year goes on. So these early non-conference games can be standalone games, can be some of the best games of the weekend. Conference games haven't started. The schedules are a little weaker. You're paying attention. And it can really set the tone for the whole year or how you view one of these teams. Those are some of the big swing games the first 3 weeks of the college football season, which begins about a week from today. We'll wrap up your Wednesday when we come back. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Now back to the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Wrapping up your Wednesday in the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow on ESPN Radio. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. Search ESPN Radio Charleston however you listen to your podcasts. And head over to charlestonsportsradio.com. Click on our show page. Find the podcast there. But also, while there at charlestonsportsradio.com, you can also stream the Morrow Midday Show. Listen online from anywhere in the world. You can always listen to the show through TuneIn Radio, your smart speaker as well, from anywhere in the world. And also our free app. Search ESPN Charleston in the App Store. And through the app, you can listen to the show live or on demand from anywhere in the world. Appreciate listeners checking in from at least 8 different states and multiple countries on this Wednesday. Download the free app today, ESPN Charleston in the App Store, and take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. The game's gotten away from the Braves a little bit. They're down 7-2 against the Phillies in the bottom of the seventh. So that one's still going on. The Mets play the Yankees tonight. Max Scherzer pitching on his birthday for the Subway Series. Braves currently 2 games behind the Mets with the trade deadline less than a week away. Braves right now getting beat up a bit by the Phillies. Again, struggling in those finales for whatever reason. If you ever miss anything from the show, catch it on demand. ESPN Radio Charleston, however you listen to your podcasts. In the meantime, life is a series of hellos and goodbyes. For now, we say goodbye. We'll say hello again tomorrow at noon. It's the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.